differences in tone,
leading many Bible scholars to argue that 2 Corinthians is actually composed of fragments of several different letters. Any way you look at it, 2 Corinthians is almost certainly a mixed letter containing different styles and varied elements such as appeals, exhortations, rebukes, threats, attacks, counterattacks, self-defense, self-praise, and irony. Were Paul alive today, I think he would take quite naturally to Twitter. What we do know is this. Paul faces accusations of having been less than honest and straightforward in dealing with the church in Corinth. Paul paid a visit to Corinth sometime after writing 1 Corinthians, which left Paul feeling embarrassed and humiliated. Paul canceled a follow-on trip and then wrote a letter that Paul refers to as the letter of tears. We join this drama as Paul, the person or persons who offended Paul, and the church are working on reconciliation. Paul's credibility as an apostle remains under attack from others outside the church, possibly Jewish Christian missionaries from Jerusalem. When we attempt to distill meaning for our lives today from a biblical text such as this, we need to remind ourselves that meaning is context-driven. And here, we know very little about the context. If we read this text solely on its own merits, Paul can come off sounding anti-Semitic. Is Paul really saying that Torah is a veil that blinds people to the glory of God? Or perhaps Paul is attempting to communicate that Torah is no longer relevant to those who follow Jesus Christ. Now, Jesus himself would likely take issue with Paul here, for Jesus said, "I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets." That said, we cannot assume that Paul knew what Jesus said about the Torah. The first of the Gospels was not written until at least a decade after Paul wrote this letter. Most likely, Paul was responding to someone or something that has been lost to time. Both the Old Testament lesson and our gospel story describe mountaintop events and human responses to mountaintop experiences. In Exodus, Moses is transfigured and transformed by his encounters with God. The people are terrified by the changes that they see in Moses. They let their fear keep them from encountering God on their own. They become content to let Moses change for them. In Luke's telling of the Transfiguration, Peter is so swept up in the glory of the moment that he does not want to leave it behind. Peter offers to build three dwellings so that they can all stay up on top of the mountain and live happily ever after. A nostalgic rush dulled Peter's sense of reality. Now, the quickest way to put the kibosh on change is to blind people with fear and to numb their minds with nostalgia. We all know of people and organizations and maybe even nations that are held back by the weight of fear or who have set the impossible standard of a glorified past. As we stand at the very edge of Lent, this is a good time to screw up our courage and look at our own lives. Where are we stuck? During a research experiment, a marine biologist placed a shark into a holding, a large holding tank, and then released several small bait fish into the tank. As you would expect, The shark quickly swam around the tank, attacked, and gobbled up all the small fish. The marine biologist then inserted a strong piece of clear plexiglass into the tank, creating two separate partitions. She then put the shark on one side of the fiberglass and a new set of bait fish on the other side. Again, the shark moved quickly to attack. This time, however, the shark slammed into the fiberglass divider and bounced off. Undeterred, the shark kept repeating this behavior every few minutes to no avail. Meanwhile, the bait fish swam around unharmed on the other side of the partition. Eventually, about an hour into the experiment, the shark gave up. This experiment was repeated several dozen times over the next few weeks. Each time, the shark got less aggressive and made fewer attempts to attack the bait fish, until eventually the shark got tired of running into the fiberglass divider and simply stopped attacking altogether. The marine biologist then removed the fiberglass divider, but the shark didn't attack. The shark was trained to believe that a barrier existed between it and the bait fish, so the bait fish swam wherever they pleased, free from harm. Many of us, after experiencing setbacks and failures, emotionally give up and stop trying. This even happens sometimes when we have a glorified experience. We don't think it can get any better, so we quit trying. We let fear of another failure keep us from another attempt, or we choose to dwell in the glories of our past. Like the shark in the story, we believe that because we were unsuccessful, we will always be unsuccessful. In other words, we continue to see a barrier where none exists. Excuse me. Much of the time, the largest hurdles to real substantive change are in our minds. There is a beautiful statue on the campus of Tuskegee University in Tuskegee, Alabama. The statue is entitled Lifting the Veil of Ignorance. The statue is of Booker T. Washington, who founded Tuskegee University in 1881. Washington is standing over a slave, lifting a veil so that the light of education can strike his face. The slave, crouched down, has a book in one hand and is using the other hand to help lift the veil. His feet are poised to stand and to move forward. The slave is looking out into the world with wide-eyed hope. A caption under the statue reads, "He lifted the veil of ignorance from his people and pointed the way to progress through education and industry." Booker T. Washington is quoted as saying, "A race, like an individual, lifts itself up by lifting others up." If we can look beyond Paul's hurt and anger, I believe Paul is trying to lift others up. Paul believes with his whole heart that the love we know in Jesus Christ has the power to transform our lives. And that when we turn to God, God's glory is reflected in us and in our lives. Then, we have the privilege and the responsibility to lift others up into the light of God's love. Throughout this life, we are given glimpses and glimmers of God's glory all around us. God does not do this to frighten us, or to give us some nostalgic memory on which to get stuck. God's glory is all about us so that we might be lifted up and that our lives might be transformed from glory.